Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Unraveling the sacred numbers and differing genealogies in Genesis chapters 4, 5, and 6 via the insights in Isaiah chapters 29 and 30 and in Matthew chapter 23 reveals a timeless struggle between flesh and the spirit. Just as the Messiah exposed the hypocrisy of religious leaders, we too are called to move beyond outward piety and cultivate a genuine relationship with God, aligning our actions with His teachings. This study challenges us to be true sons of God, in Romans 8, walking in the Spirit and resisting the temptations that have ensnared humanity since the days of Noah, mentioned in Isaiah 54, Matthew 24, Luke 17, and 1 Peter chapter 3.
So before I go too far into just 5, I want to bring up to you a common argument or disagreement or frustration, maybe all those words combined together, I'm not sure, is that when semi-secular people who question God, or if it's right, or if he's real or not, typically they run across, or this is the common section, chapter 5, runs across, and they just say, oh, it's all myth, because the ages are so long. How long they lived. They lived hundreds and hundreds of years, or nearly 1,000 years in some cases. And it's hard for us to wrap our minds around those time slots. And to be fair, I won't argue too much against their questioning, is that in our Bibles, we have certain ages listed on like how old they are at certain times. Like, for example, when Adam's a certain age, his wife gives birth to Seth, and a certain age, whoever Seth married, gives birth to such and such. And it keeps on that route. And so it has these really long times. And there is, for lack of a better term, inconsistency in our historical manuscripts. So for example, we have our Bibles, which are based on a Masoretic text. They have certain ages and years listed on these gentlemen and these men's names and how old they were at certain events. And then you have the Septuagint dates, which are significantly older for some of these men. They're basically take 100 years to almost all of them. The Septuagint before they give birth to or have another child. And then Josephus, of course, pretty much matches Septuagint's lists. But then the Masoretic text obviously shaves off hundreds of years. So when people attempt to do backwards calculations or how old is the earth, it's this age or that age or blah, 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 they go with very wildly different numbers. So for example, if you use a historical documentation, not Masoretic texts, you get numbers around at creation about 55-ish, 100 BC, give or take about 100 years. So some documents will have the earth with Adam and Eve. Adam created somewhere around 50 or so BC. And that you have some, that Josephus has it, like it's 54-60 BC, and then you have the Masoretic text, like 470 something. I don't know what it is. All these different texts, they all have contradictory numbers. And so it frustrates people like me who's curious how come the numbers are different. But not that it matters. It doesn't matter what the numbers actually happen to be, because it don't change what I do, whether one date is more accurate than the other date. But it is interesting in that they have contradictory informations, and they don't always agree. They don't have to agree, but these years are really hard to wrap our minds around. I can't imagine what it's like to be 1,000 years old. I just can't. Yeah. I can't imagine what it means to have a child. What I mean by hundreds, I just can't fathom what that looks like. I could say, oh well, you know, I'm in my 40s. I could try to extrapolate differences. I would be equivalent to a 400-year-old man, give or take. I don't think so. I just don't think that's quite accurate. So before I get too deep into these different controversial numbers, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on these because they're not terribly useful or relevant. But I do want to point out one thing to you, which I think is interesting pattern. So mathematicians have been doing this for a long time. Samaritans did it year, like thousands of years ago. This for a long time. And they notice patterns of these numbers. So for those of you who are familiar with your Bibles, you'll note the Bible has what religious scholars call sacred numbers. What I mean, for example, I'll write a few sacred numbers, which you're all very, very familiar with. You're familiar with the number 7, right? Who doesn't know that if you've ever read the Bible in your life, right? Seven, super, super common. It's called a sacred number, classified sacred number. We like the 7 days of creation, which is the most common one. We'll cover actually a lot more of that today about that. Two is not classified sacred number, but one is a sacred number. One sacred number. Three is a sacred number. They're not a very good one, but it's a common one. Seven, obviously. We have 12. You like the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Yeah, eight has sacred number as well. So the point being, there's other numbers too. There's like, 40, you got 49, you got 70. There's various numbers that are classed with sacred numbers. What I mean by sacred number is a number commonly used inside a sacred text. I don't mean that the number is holy. Is it holy about the number seven? Or it's that it's used frequently inside a sacred or religious text. And our Bible uses numbers like these really, really frequently, all the time. And actually Genesis 1 has an obscene number of the number seven in it. Just like hundreds of times is written number sevens inside that, which we can get that later. It's not a number form. It's the repetition of certain words. So the sacred numbers are common. Well, in our biblical text, you'll note that these men's ages of the how many hundreds of years old they are or when they had kids. There's all sacred numbers written in there. Now, this part, I think Daniel Agee thinks is interesting. It may not be to you, but we know our text, our biblical text has sacred numbers. But in the case of other religious traditions, there's a different numbers that are classified as sacred. And you all are very, very familiar with them too. You see them all the time. So in this case, the most common one, the biggest one is 60. Why is it 60? Because that's how we get our angles, 360 degrees in a circle, right? See it all the time? The sacred number is 60, the Samaritan sacred number. They're like, well, so what? Who cares? The reason why 60 is sacred is because it has the most number of divisible things goes into it. One goes into it, two goes into it, three goes into it, four goes into it, five goes into it, all evenly. That's why Samaritans did that. It's just my wife was confused. Like, what are you talking about? Anyway, so why I say this is because Noah and Moses, I presume Noah gathered these men's names and ages. I'm assuming that's the case. And he's the one who brought them through the flood. So we have the records of how old they were. I'm assuming maybe it's one of his sons did. I don't know. Somebody did. And Noah and Moses writing them down later or compiling or finding them later. I'm not sure. They come from what we classify as Samaritan background, Sumeritan, which means because when Noah's ark rested or wherever it rested, they then populated, we'd call like a modern day, like Iraq territory, the Middle East, right? That's Samaritans. So the Samaritans were there. And so when Noah is writing this number down or his sons or grandkids or whatever, whoever's writing it all down, they have a sacred number text there for their gods of that day. Of not saying Noah had different gods, but they're just his descendants had different gods. And 60 was their magic number. So you'll note when you look at all the ages of these men, they've been carried over most likely, I can't guarantee, most likely over through maybe Shem or to Abraham. Somebody got to hold the number. Somebody did. I don't know who it did. It carries through how it gets in our Bibles. But you'll note that all the ages inside the men who's listed here are all based on 60, which is interesting. You'll note, I'm not brilliant here. So you'll note that there's certain numbers that are missing out of all their ages, and it's the ending number is their key trigger. So you note there is no 1, 3, 4, 6, or 8 at the end of any of the numbers from Adam to Abraham. But yes, you also, oh yes, Hannah, what's your question? 40, yes, it's in our Bible, but 40 is used in our Bible multiple times. 40 days, exactly. Yeah, that's what the sacred number. So 40 years, exactly. So 40 is used. You're correct, Hannah. That's one of the sacred numbers in our biblical text. So why I'm bringing this up to you, the only reason I bring it up to you is because it's curiosity. It's an interesting thing as to why or how numbers transitioned. I say numbers transitioned. As you'll note that as later on, I think it's Genesis 11, I think it is, the ages start shrinking a lot, right? You all notice that? We even notice their ages shrink. They could get to lines like 150 or whatever, they start dropping in numbers. And people just go, well, what happened? What changed? Did something atmospherically change and now we just dies younger? Did some disease take out our genetic codes and did genes start shutting down? And I'm sure all those things may be true. I don't really know. But they did notice that even the numbers shrank, it's because people argued, Abraham came from a Samaritan background and shifted over to the Palestinian Egyptian background. He moved to the Canaanite territory, right? We all know that, right? Abraham moved to Canaan, right? Well, Canaans don't use 60, they use decimals, base 10. Right. That, exactly. Because the numbers are all different. They're built by different number sequences. And so they said, wait a minute, the ages may or may not have changed. We don't know, but the counting system changed. So Samaritans didn't care about the accurate number. They cared about how important the person was. If you were super important, your age had to be a multiple of 60. If you were semi-important, but still be good, hit a multiple of 6. Or 12, or whatever the age or event in your life, be a multiple of one of those. And so they know that all the ages are all multiples of either 60 years, 60 months, 60 days. They're all a multiple of 60 when you add them all up. They all are multiples of 60. And that was interesting about why that is, or 6, I should say. And I don't know the reason why. I don't know if God was using their number system in how long he let these men live. I have no idea, but it is a curiosity as to why that is. That I don't know what it is, but it's there, and it's quite obvious. They did all the numbers and crunched everybody's number and age listed in our Bible. They have a 1 billion to 1 chance that this is true, and it is. So okay, it can't be an accident. There's a 1,000,000,000% chance, or 1,000,000,000 times, what is it, 1 billion to 1, whatever it is, that this would actually take place in all these men's ages, and it does. So okay, somebody somehow recorded or planned this out and make it look like this. I don't know who, don't know why, don't know what the goal was, but it is an interesting thing that apparently, if all these men's ages are correct, God was utilizing the 60 base system as well as our 7 concept, base of 7s and 12s and such that we're familiar with in our biblical text. I don't know why God was doing it, but it is interesting as to why God, or that God did seem to do this. Yes, Yosef, you used to think, Oh, there's a disease. Right. So he also was questioning, he said, well, maybe he used to think there was some kind of a disease that took place and people just started to die younger. I don't know. Maybe that could happen. I'm not sure. But it is an interesting note, at least to me, it's interesting, that a number-based system happens to have so much prevalence within inside of these men's ages, and then it essentially dies off or diminishes or goes away by the time Abraham dies, or basically when Isaac's born. All this base 60 system just vanishes. And now we're the normal decimal system, the chronology that we as Europeans understand and comprehend. So I don't know why it is. I just noticed that it is. And so for some reason, God has it hidden in here. Maybe he has some other purpose or some objective to hide these number messages in here. I don't know what it is. Maybe somebody else does or could figure it out for me or write a book about it. But, actually, to be fair, there are a lot of books written about this, honestly. I ran across half dozen already just yesterday. There are a lot of books about this exact topic as to what happened here. And they're trying to figure out, and like, it's so bizarre that the Bible does this. And so it's an interesting topic. To me, at least, it's interesting. But what I want to bring more your interest attention to, it doesn't matter how old the men necessarily lived or didn't live. What our Bible is concerned with is more of when they had the child that we're interested in talking about. So, for example, we have Adam, of course, has Cain, Abel, and Seth. We know those three men. Although, according to Josephus, he had 33 children. That's 3 times 11. 33 males. Scratch that. 33 male sons altogether. And 23 female daughters altogether in his lifetime. That's according to Josephus' records. I don't know if Josephus is right or wrong, but the point is he had lots of kids. But our biblical reference or interest is in the particular child that he talks about. So it goes from Adam to Seth. And then, of course, as our records go on, this, you know, should all the various other ages. So even though we as Americans and traditional readers would interpret the next child born, like that age sequence, we would normally interpret it as that's supposed to be their first child. Doesn't have to be. It's the child they're interested in. So, for example, Moses was not the first one born. Aaron was older, and Jacob had lots of sons. Right? Some were older, some were younger, and so we have records of some of their age and all of them. he didn't focus on the oldest one was not the primary character. It was the important one. He could have kids before or after. He could have had daughters, a few daughters before Seth was born. Who knows? It doesn't make a difference. Point is, we're interested in the one that's named Seth as we go on to our sequence. And of course, Seth, similarly, he had Enosh. Well, again, whether Enosh was his firstborn child is not the relevant question. It's about that Enosh is the one we're counting. That's what we care about. And I bring this up to you is because in our Torah portion here, we have an oddity that comes up. I don't know if any of you caught this or not when you're reading it. Jeff's translation, I think, caught it, but I'm not sure if all of you noticed it or not when he read it. So most of our Bibles record an interesting word choice in a particular moment in time in chapter 5 of Genesis, which I'm going to bring your attention to. So in this sequence, you have these are called the genealogies of Adam, right? The makings of God, he created them, this is a side note for those of you who actually care about these silly things. So Adam is called Adam, right? And Chava Eve, for Eve is Eve. But God calls Adam and Eve together Adam. So he names Adam and Eve are called Adam. And Adam is called Adam. Or it's like you pick what? So Adam, God calls Adam or Adam man. And then, which we in Hebrew, it's Ish. And then, of course, you have Isha. I think, but we translate it as Eve, right? Right. And that's I should capitalize, I guess. She was called a woman, but her name was Chava. Anyway, but God calls in chapter 5 Adam and Eve together. He calls them Adam. So their combined unit is Adam. And I think it's funny. It's just me to funny because Eve was made from him. And so he said, yeah. So you were one, but now you're two, but you're actually one. So he shoves both together. You're all Adam. You're all man. It doesn't matter if you're female, man, you're all man. I think it's a funny thing to me. My sense of humor. Yeah. We won't discuss the current school systems. Women are not males. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to jump into modern day school. Transgender, crazy nut job stuff. We're just saying that God combines male and female as one unit, when they're married, which I think is funny. I find it comical. Maybe not everybody does. But anyway, so when it goes to the genealogy of Adam, as in the cycle, in each of their sons, he calls them Yalad. So in Hebrew, they had different words for different things, right? So I have a generation, generation. There's super Hebrew words for it, but this is more of a genealogy. So genealogy, I can say spell I spell genealogy. It doesn't make a difference. So Yalad, Y-A-L-A-D. That's an English transliteration. It's not spelled that way. That's what they call it, but except one time when Noah's has kids, they're called Ben sons. So in Noah, we reach at the end of it, his children are called sons, Ben. And he's the only one that does that. And we think, so what? It is not a so what. There's actually a reason for this. So when we reach toward the end of chapter 5 and Noah has kids at roughly around 500 years old, there's a few things about that time cycle here. So roughly was he 500 years old, he has his three sons are alive. I'm not sure how old they were, the years they were born. People debate that. But they're alive at that time. They're called the sons of Noah. And so, but all the generations leading up to in chapter 5 are all, the begats are Yalad, right? In this case, the sons are, so the begats being the begat, the character our Bibles translate as begat or begot as Yalad. But in this case of Noah, he actually has the Ben, the son is the one, the son to Noah. And we ask, it's all the sons. I think I don't know if it is plural, I didn't check if it's benign. Anyway, it's the same word. So why? Why does the change, and why does Noah wait till he's 500 years old to have any kids, or at least have these sons? And according to our Noah's story, the flood story, he only has three kids total. It's just those three boys. He doesn't have a daughters, or if he did, they don't make it to the flood. Their husbands didn't come or whatever. There's no record of them. So we know he has at least this, and he has it at 500 years old. Contrast that to the ripe old spring chicken age of 120, which is the average rest of them. you just think free chicken 120, but they're averaging 120 years old, give or take, and he's at 500. He has kids. When you ask yourselves, why? Why did Noah wait so long to have children compared to all of his prisons, all of his persons before him? You think possibly, Gloria, that's in God's hands? I don't think so. There's actually a reason for what's going on here, and this is possibly what a possible explanation is. Exactly. So Isaac's pointed out, the only being the only good person on earth, you have a hard time trouble finding a wife. And there's some actual merit to that question, that comment. So we go through this. We'll jump to Isaiah and Matthew later. We go with all these years, and so and so lives so long, all that kind of good stuff. Jumping down here, so we have Lamech at verse 30, chapter 5. He lives 500 years. The Lamech were 777. Now, verse 23. When Noah's 500 years old, Noah's B'nai, or sons, were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, in verse chapter 6, verse 1, came about when man began to increase the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good, and they took themselves wives, whoever they chose. So we have an interesting scenario going on here. If you recall the tail end of chapter 4, the last verse there, at chapter 4 of Genesis, when Seth was born, so Adam's like 130 years old thereabouts. When Seth was born, he says that he named him Seth. Not when Seth was born. When Enosh was born, so Seth had a son. So Enosh was born. He named it Enosh, and then people then called on the name of the Lord profane. So they started to profane God's name. So way back when we have these men, I should draw a picture up here. I didn't do that. It's basically the same thing as your guys' chart, those of you who saw. You got all these guys. Yeah, you got Adam. We'll put it, hit the beard little chart. You have Seth. He has a beard little chart. Your little chart had the yellow chart background. And you got Enosh. He has a beard with a chart. It's how many years he lived. Basically, when this guy's born, people started praying God's name, which means the word means is profane. It's not, so some of our Bibles are translated as will call upon the name of the Lord or began to call. The word actually means to profane, to ruin, or to damage. That's what the word means in Hebrew. So that's what they started to do when Enosh was born. That's not that far along in comparison to the roughly 2,000 years, give or take, before the flood shows up. So at the first couple hundred years, people started to curse God's name essentially. Destroy it, make fun of it, or damage it, or ruin it in some capacity. I don't know what it looked like. It doesn't even make a difference. But God is noting this. So then you have generation after generation after generation after generation coming along. For all these generations come along to Noah, how many people are cursing God's name? Well, God then points out, it says, God said, my spirit, verse 3 of chapter 6, shall not contend evermore concerning man, since he is but flesh. His days be 120 years. So at this point from verse chapter 6 onward until the flood, God only calls mankind flesh. Doesn't call them sons. Calls them flesh. Doesn't call them men. Calls them flesh. Something changed. God saw a difference. There's a detachment going on, a separation between God and men. So in this story, it seems to have started during Enosh's birth or near his birth when he was born. I'm not sure the exact year. And then from that point forward, all the way through until we have the end of the flood from chapter 6, as far as this whole, all these years and years and years going by, men were essentially were starting to curse or damage or profane God's name. They were making light or of unuse or mocking potentially. I'm not sure what all they were doing. They're disgracing God. And so by the time Noah shows up, if people are doing this and God is observing, this is terrible. Isaac's question point is right. How many good people are left? Remind you, according to our biblical text, in Noah, he's the last one. He's the last one. His sons, of course, but he's the last one. So who are you going to find a daughter from or a wife from? All the people who are awful, right? He could convert her. He could try to be an evangelist. Yes, Joseph? He's like cursing God's name. Well, that we're not going to discussing Islam. Sorry, son, but we'll discuss this some other time. So about cursing, that topic. So in this cycle of this process. So when Noah's 500 years old, he waits 500 years old, and there's no record of him being married yet, or if he has daughters, we have no record of it. It is conceivable or possible he didn't see much worthwhile saving, as far as the people to marry or to interact with. So in the description given here, which I'm going to, by the way, for those of you who subscribe to the, you know, sons of God being angels, I don't subscribe to that. So you can think that or believe that, or demons, I don't subscribe to that. I have my own disagreement with that philosophy, because I'm more of a consistent context matters. So sons of God are defined in a biblical text in both the Apostle Paul finds it as someone who is following God. That a son of God is for someone who's following God, who is having relation with God back and forth, an interaction with Him, obedient to Him. That is a son of God, all right? And there are many sons of God. We have lots of them described in our Bibles. We have tons of people who, the prophets were all sons of God. Obviously, the as Apostle Paul points out, anybody who follows God and follows Messiah is also a son of God. We're all sons of God who do these things. So that's how Apostle Paul defines it. There's one of prophet also discusses the same thing. That's how it's being talked about. So I define sons of God as men who have a relationship with God. That's how I define it, because that's how Apostle Paul defined it. So let's pretend for a minute all these guys had, how old they were, had a relationship with God. But instead of sticking with that, they found the daughters of men, and that changed the relationship to be focused upon the girls instead of God. Many of them had multiple wives, right? At least we know a record of one of them, but according to Josephus, they had, a lot of them had many, many wives. So the question being is that if I have a relationship, let's put me up here as a stick figure. If I have a relationship with God, I'll put God as a cloud hanging out, and I'm talking to him back and forth. And I have the relationship growing up or at a certain point in my life. And then I see this pretty girl, Lorianne. No, you're not being played by downfall. So I say, pretty girl, say, wow, she's great. And then I abandon God with this new relationship. I am no longer a son of God. I'm now just flesh. See, get the idea? That's the concept behind the idea of definition, of biblical definition of flesh. A flesh versus, or a base person, a flesh versus a godly person, is that you ignore your spiritual concept, ignore your spiritual connection, and said revert to a fleshly desires, or fleshly, the spiritual concept becomes fleshly only. So, and of course, these men, I'm not them, Lorianne, don't worry. They have lots of different wives. I don't know how many. Okay, they're not maids, they're wives. Okay. So, yeah, one of wives, and I don't know how many kids they have, but lots of wives. So this became their distraction, and we have an example of this with King Solomon. And God specifically talked about this exact problem. If you marry or start increasing wives, you will decrease your connection to me. Because God reiterates it with King Solomon in the Torah, says, don't do this. Why? I think because he saw it before. I said, God said, I've been here before. I know what this is. And what it turns into, Solomon, don't do that. Of course, he didn't listen. But the point is, he should have. And other kings, they're supposed to listen. Okay, yeah, he did not listen on a big scale. He did like the exceptionally, like extraordinarily not listen. So if basically he replaced, in King Solomon's, and the description, of course, with other kings as well, he replaced the relationship and connection to God with the relationship connection to all the different women and wives they had or accumulated for themselves. And that, as we saw with King Solomon, even King David at some level, it pulls their heart away from the relationship with God, doesn't it? It did with Solomon quite clearly. We prove that, and Bible book text proves that. So, and we have other examples similarly. It draws and pulls them different directions. Okay, I can't deal with this. Even with Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, he was struggling. I don't know how to deal with this problem. These two women who are fighting, and it was stressful to him, which granted it should be, but it was stressful to him. And so it was also straining on his relationships as well. All those strain. So this turns into a desire for flesh as opposed to a desire for a true connection with God. So the sons of God stop being sons of God and start becoming fleshly people. Hence, God says, I'm not dealing with flesh anymore. I'm done with it. All mankind is just flesh. Noah, I'll deal with you. Now, Noah's struggling at this at roughly 500 years old. Some argue he could have been you know, 480 because God gives 120 years. That's Noah doesn't have any kids. So at some point in time, God comes along and talks to Noah. I'll give Noah a stick figure. He's bigger than me. He's a larger stick figure. He's more important. Talks to Noah and says, hey, I'm going to wipe out mankind. So build a big boat, right? This is what he's going to say, right? Eventually with little holes and water. So, but he gives Noah 120 years. And at this point, I think Daniel just thinks, Noah realizes, wait a minute, if he wipes out all flesh, all human beings die too, right? Including the descendancy of children, human beings. So at this point in time, somewhere around 500 years old, give or take 20 years, Noah's realizing mankind's wipe out, I need to have kids. I'm going to have to bring them with me to bring them through the ark. That's my opinion, that Noah made this realization, hence at 500. I don't know who he married. Some may argue who he married. Doesn't make a difference. He married somebody and had kids with them. So that's my opinion why Noah waited so long. He didn't seem much worth having being married to. And God said, your time's up. You got to choose now. Choose somebody. I don't know for certain, but he was the last one. When God selects this, he's the last human being. God says he's the only one left. None of the women are left. None of the men are left. He's the only one worth saving. Then God talks to him. Okay, you're the last guy. You're it. I'll save you, but you got to find somebody, some woman to bring with you. Don't know who it is. Find somebody. She's worthwhile marrying and have kids with her because you got 120 years. Your time's up. So Noah, I think, made this realization somewhere along the way. I'm not sure when, like what year it was, but somehow Noah does this. But it's hence he waits such a long time and didn't intend to have kids, apparently. Hope I didn't lose you guys. Okay, I'm not insulting you, dear. No, okay. All right. Good. No, it does not mention Noah's kids being righteous at all. Noah's Noah, specifically. From whatever culture he married, right? He's got to bring that culture in with him, whoever it is, right? And whoever they married. So, yeah, because all those sons had three wives, right? So he got three wives come into. So he's the righteous individual. He has three kids who I don't know who Noah's married to. She had to come from somebody who wasn't him, obviously. So she probably wasn't the righteous category God was looking for. Maybe she was, I don't know. But Noah's being called that. And so it implies that the wives he finds for, or his sons find, however they marry, had to also come from some of these other guys who weren't so great either. And you're bringing that process in. So it's a heavy responsibility on Noah's side as well as his son's side. But we don't know the level or righteousness of his sons. We know Canaan, which is descended of Ham, wasn't so great. And it appears Ham may not have been. But we don't know the details about the rest of the boys as far as that's concerned. But there is some thread of frustration that God refers to mankind from this point forward as flesh. They're just flesh. They're not sons. They're just flesh. And I bring that up because a son of God is an important category to belong to. We all want to be a sons of God. It's important to belong to, and Noah belonged because God saved him. And clearly God saved him. So I'm going to erase this because I have other things to talk about. So in our Torah portion cycle, which I'm almost done with this, I'm nearly done with it, because of course God repents from this process and want to wipe it all out from man to animal. I don't know what God has as the animals. I don't know what they were doing that was so bad, but whatever, he said he would wipe them out too. So I won't go into the details. Yes, corrupted animals. Could be corrupted with the spirit of people. That's possible. We're going to jump forward to our Haftorah portion, which was Isaiah 30, which is part of our songs today. Because this is another topic that is highly connected to this in the similar thread, though it's a different concept. So I'm going to put a chart up here real quick, don't lose anybody. So in Genesis, we had Noah, who God said, you were the something worth saving. You're the only righteous one left. And the characteristic difference between Noah and the others was that Noah focused his attention on what God wanted was good versus bad, right? So Noah did his actions, which is action-based. Oops, that's a C, not an A. Action was all based upon doing good in God's eyes versus and not bad. So this is an action-based category for Noah. And of course, God says, here's your action, produce a boat to me later on, which we'll read the next cycle, next Torah portion. In the case of Isaiah, we have a slightly different variation. So Isaiah 30, now we're not reading all of Isaiah 30. This is just a small snippet, my light. We hit that light. My light makes a shiny thing off this thing on the screen. You can't even see the word Isaiah on it. Thank you. Thank you. So Isaiah, so he has different, Isaiah 30, we're only going technically from verse 8 to 15, which is not so great. So in the case of Isaiah 30, verses 8 to 15, we're jumping into Isaiah in a section that is actually much bigger than this. So it's really hard to isolate it down and just take a snapshot or small snippet out, because you get really distorted viewpoint. But Isaiah 30, verses 8, discusses the fact that he has to write certain document information down a document. This is a direct contrast to Isaiah 29, the first one, which is another document that he was supposed to hide. This is like a parallel passage here. So go back to Isaiah 30, as in verse 8, go down, write this prophecy tablet, the presence, and inscribe it in a book, and let it remain to the final days forever and eternity. And it is what's in the document is, this is a rebellious people, dishonest children who are not willing to hear the teaching of Jehovah. So say the seers do not see, the prophets do not see true visions for us, speak pleasant things to us and see fantasies for us or imaginative for us, veer away and stray from the path, remove from our presence the word of the Holy One of Israel. So in this case, in the case of Noah's day, the people of his day that weren't Noah, of course, they were going into flesh. They were all flesh-based concept, which I would categorize as self-pleasure or self-indulgence, just doing whatever they felt like doing because they could. In the case of Isaiah, in this section, I had a terrible penmanship here. In the case of Isaiah, in this section, we have they're actually being instructed. So these people are telling the prophets to be quiet. So telling actually essentially God, because they're talking to the prophets, to be quiet. Be quiet. They don't want to hear it anymore. So they're not just like obeying their own fleshly desires, to make a conscious decision. I don't want to hear this. Don't tell me. I don't care what it says. Don't speak to me anything that's bad. I don't want to hear good, positive, you know, good job, pat on the back. Everything I do is good. It's all good to me type of thing. That's what they're being told, what they're telling. It's funny because in chapter 29, which discusses a similar thing in verses 9 through 12, which is a parallel. So Isaiah does this parallel comparison. 1 in 29, they're trying to read the book and they can't understand it. And in 30, they don't want to read the book. They want to hide it. So there's two different things. So there's two different processes here going. Same document. One is they're trying to read, they're confused. And they say, I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear it anymore. I want to just throw it away. Same information in the book. So in 29, just to read this, you have context of verse 30. Upon it, be astonished. They've been utterly blinded. They were drunk, but not from wine. They staggered, but not from liquor. It says, for the Lord has poured upon you a spirit of deep sleep. He has closed your eyes. He has covered the prophets and your chiefs and the seers. To you, all the prophecy is like the words of a sealed document, which one gives to a literate person saying, read this, because I cannot, it is sealed. And documents given to an illiterate person saying, read this, and I cannot read, I'm illiterate. So one is that I have this document, I'm blinded, I need somebody to see it, explain it to me in 29. And then 30 is that not only do I not want to have it explained to me, don't even write it, make it go away, hide this thing. But of course, in Isaiah is told to have it all saved all the way for eternity, that this is the case. So, and they don't want to hear it anymore. It's a conscious decision to avoid God, to avoid God's instructions. Verse 12. Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, since you have despised this word and you trusted in robbery and waywardness and have depended upon it, therefore this sin will be for you like the breach of a fallen wall, like the bulge of a lofty wall, whose collapse comes with a quick suddenness. God will break it as one breaks a potter's flask or fragments. He will have no pity, and there will not be found among the fragments a shard to scrape for burning coal from a fire or scoop water from a cistern. So it'll be very, very quick. Now, in the flood, for Noah's story, we could argue it was quick, or you could argue it's not. It had 120 years roughly from God to speak until he goes in the ark. So it's a long time. But then again, when people weren't ready for it or weren't aware, didn't care, it probably would be fairly sudden on them. That would be, I was just reading passage 20. That was Isaiah. I'd read both Isaiah 29, the text here. The question, Isaiah 29, I'd read that from verses 9 through 12, and then went back to Isaiah 30, and that was verse 12 through 14. That's what the question that was asked. So in this section here, we have the people being telling the prophets to be quiet. I don't want to hear it anymore. And in this one, it was, I guess you could argue, somewhat sudden in the case of Noah's time. But in the case of Isaiah, God's saying it's going to be sudden. I have never seen personally a brick wall fall. But I can imagine when you take enough bricks at the bottom, the whole thing collapses rather quickly. It's like Jenga, exactly like Jenga, exactly the Jenga game, exactly. So you take all the stuff at the bottom, eventually, well, I'll call it. That's kind of how I imagine it. That's a great comparison. So in this, you're choosing to be quiet. You're choosing to tell God to be quiet. You want to hear what He has to say, but only focus on what is good. Then it's going to fall. It's going to appear very sudden to you, won't it? Now, on the other hand, let's pretend you were not wanting God to be quiet, and you personally were studying and searching and finding God and finding out what He has to say. Would the fall then be sudden to you? No, it would not. You'd be seeing it coming. It'd be obvious. Well, the prophet saw it quite obvious. So it only becomes sudden to those who are not observant or watching or looking for it, right? Makes sense, right? Like the night. So in Noah's case, was a flood sudden? Well, of course not. Yeah, 120 years to work with. That's not sudden. In the case of the prophet Isaiah, would this be sudden? No, it was not sudden. His whole life dedicated to this process, years and years and years. It happened a couple, like 100 years later. It's not sudden at all to him. But the people who are living it, who don't want to hear, it would be sudden to them. In both categories. Yeah, those who are not listening, it becomes very sudden very quickly. So let's see what. So we're almost finished here with verse, Isaiah, back to Isaiah 30, verse, was it? 15. For thus says my Lord Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel, in stillness and peacefulness will you be saved, in quiet and confidence will be your might. But you did not consent. And you said, no, we will flee on a horse. Therefore, you will flee, and we will ride upon, and we are swift animals. Therefore, your pursuers will be swifter. So that's verse 15, 16. So in their reasoning, the reason of Isaiah 30, their reasoning time slot, what they're talking about here from those last few verses, I know I went a little past from what I was supposed to, but their reason is that we don't need you, God, to talk to us. We will do it. We'll do it. We'll flee when the bad things come. We don't need you to save us. We're not interested in that. And God says, okay, go ahead and flee, and they'll be faster than you. Yeah, back to yours. I'll do it. Do it. I don't need you, God. We'll take care of all the problems. You go away. We're fine. And God says, not a problem. And the people who are pursuing you will be quicker than you. Those who are fleeing you will capture you anyway. They'll be better and stronger and more effective than you are because you're depending on yourself. That kind of makes sense when it loses anybody. So this, the philosophy, I imagine in my Daniel Age's mind, the people of Noah's day probably had a similar concept. Noah, you're full of it. There'll be a flood. You're crazy. I'll just build my own boat. I'll go to the mountains. I'll be fine. Right? All those things. I don't need you, Noah, to save me. I don't need you, God, to save me in Noah's day. I'll take care of myself. I don't need this. I imagine it's probably something he may have heard. I don't know for certain, but I guess he might have heard, like, making fun of him, most likely. I don't know. But I would guess that. And of no interest in using God's methodology of saving. Similar to Isaiah, no interest in God's methodology of saving. It's the same philosophy, same threaded thought process. None of these categories, not Noah himself, but the people of Noah's generation or people of Isaiah that he's talking about are what I would classify as a son of God. They're not people who are following or studying God's way. Noah clearly was. Isaiah obviously is. And people who are reasoning, studying Isaiah obviously are. They're studying, they're classified to be sons of God. That's their job. That's what they're doing. But the people who are saying, be quiet, I'll do my own thing, they're not sons of God here. Now let's jump to Matthew 23. Right, exactly. So Joy was saying, and all those people, she imagines them saying, yeah, I'm a good person. I don't need, yeah, I'm good. God and I have an understanding. I didn't do anything wrong. Well, some people, yeah, that's true, Joseph. Okay, so Matthew 23, which we have a little bit about this topic too. This is a different, same problem, but a different manifestation of it. So the exact same scenario, but it just looks a little different than what we would necessarily appear to be. So in this case, when we had Noah, we were talking to people who had no interest in Noah's saving, you know, doing what is right or wrong. They're doing what is right. They're focused on their fleshly acts, their fleshly, as opposed to what Noah's doing. They focus on doing the flesh stuff. I'll shut that down. Flesh was the interest at this time during Noah's time. In the case of Isaiah 20, they said, we'll take care of ourselves, God, we don't need you. It's still a self-goal, self-oriented philosophy, whether you're focused on your flesh, your own desires in Noah's day, or you're focused on, I'll do it, take care of myself in Isaiah's day. In the case of Matthew, so Matthew 23 has a lot of, you know, woe to you Pharisees, that Messiah says over and over and over again, woe to you, all these things. And it's interesting. So it starts out, which this is, what's the right word? A controversial section. Okay. In the first 12 verses. So it starts out, says, hey, Jesus speaking to the multitudes of people and to disciples themselves. Says, hey, the scribes, Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. So he's making a category. So I'll put a little seat up here. So you have Moses' seat with a little chair, right? And you got Moses, he has the hands out. We'll put a little hat and some hair. Okay, so Moses sitting in Moses' seat. The scribes and Pharisees, hey, we'll put a little rock, it's a little steps you have to walk up to, right? It looks a little bit like a throne. So Moses and Pharisees, sitting in Moses' seat. What is Moses' seat? What would he do when he was alive? He was taking care of the judgments of all the questions. Hey, what did God say about this? What about this guy? He hit so-and-so. What does he owe him? This guy stole such and such. What does he do? They were dealing with the day-to-day problems that take place in a society. And of course, Moses gave him the instructions from God. God said, do this. God says, do that. God says, don't do this. God says, stop doing that. And they got, so now God really got mad at you. Really, really stopped it up too late. Those problems took along the way. As they waited, they didn't obey. And then a few were whacked along the process. So that's kind of Moses' main job. Don't do that. And then, nope, it should stop too late. And now you got to deal with it. So if you're sitting in Moses' seat, what is in your responsibility? The same as his. So God said, do this. God said, don't do that. Stop doing that. Too late. Now you got problems. This is how you deal with it. It's Moses' job. Now, what if I sit Moses' seat and give you something that God didn't say? God says, stand on one foot, upside down, and give me $5 million a week. Those are things that Moses didn't say, and God didn't say them, right? So you could sit in Moses' seat and say garbage, right? And does that mean, I could, I'm not saying it's a good thing, I'm not saying it would turn out well for me, which is, you could theoretically do so. So when Jesus writes us, do what they say and not what they do, well, okay, wait a minute. There's an obvious answer. There's an obvious context going on here. Do what they say with respect to their job of Moses. Because if they tell you, bear your phylacteries long and do all these things in the synagogue and all these, if they tell you to do it, you have to go do it. That makes no sense. Because he says, it goes by the next word, and they do all these things and it's nuts. They shouldn't do them at all. So it's within context of Moses. So in this case, the Pharisees are supposed to tell you what Moses said. So essentially, which they're speaking, I'll put a word bubble here, whatever God says to do. So that's what his job is, to tell you what God's relaying to the people and what you should and shouldn't do in the context of Moses. When he comes down from the seat, let's say we'll call this guy, he's sitting Moses, we'll call him Bob. So when Bob comes down after sitting up there for so many hours, well, I know, but now he's sitting in Moses' seat. Not Moses anymore. It was just the seat of Moses. So now it's Bob. So Bob comes down a few thousand years later and he says, okay, I'm Bob, stick figure with his little hair. And everybody should do the hokey pokey, right? Let's all dance, right? That's what it's all about. So he's no longer speaking as Moses, is he? He's speaking for himself. He likes the hokey pokey. So the point is that it's not about, even though he says to do it, he's not speaking for God anymore. He's speaking for himself. Now, if he takes the hokey pokey, I don't know how to spell hokey pokey. He says, okay. And then he goes back on the Moses seat and says, everybody, I told you the hokey pokey. Now he's taking something that's out of context, doesn't belong, and put it as if God said it. And now we have a problem. You can't do that. You don't take your personal viewpoint and opinion and bring it out to Moses if this is what Moses and God said. That's garbage. So there's an obvious things we can see clearly that it'd be absurd. So that's the idea. Now we have these people sitting in Moses' seat, and now Messiah comes along and tells them, hey, these are just, they're men that within the context of Moses, what they say, what Moses said, that's fair, but it's good to go outside of that, don't obey. And then it goes with this, woe, scribes and Pharisees. Now these guys, I'm going to erase the hokey pokey comment because that wasn't really the point of the story. It's not what it's all about. So he comes off Moses' seat, whatever he does. And so now Messiah is pointing out that, okay, now you have problems. this guy has actions and things he does. He has a laundry list. We'll give him a laundry list of things. It's a really long laundry list. All these different things he has on his laundry list that he does. It's a long list. And whatever, however, whatever he puts on it. And these items are what is saying, Messiah is saying, this is silliness. This is absurd stuff here. But on the outside of them, the appearance, they look very similar to Noah, don't they? They look on the outside, the guy saying hokey pokey, he looks like Noah. His actions look great. He looks like a righteous individual, doing what God wants him, praying all the time. He looks like Noah. He also looks like Isaiah. Oh, we study the Bible, read it this, read that way, read all five languages of it, 14 translations, go back and forth, and debate it all day long. He looks like Isaiah, but besides pointing out, he's not. He looks at the outside, but the inside, he isn't. So we have these different comparisons, different scenarios. This guy, he likes the hokey pokey. So he does stuff that on the outside looks fine, but internally he's corrupt. Yes, Joseph? He looks righteous, he does the hokey pokey. He does. So on the inside, he's bad. So inside is bad, but outside, good. Oh, like a spoiled can of beans. Yeah, that ferments and it looks, yeah. Exactly. The outside looks good. Looks like it's been canned well. You open it up, you eat it, and you die. Not so good. So in this case, we have different categories, different categories of non-sons of God. We have the people who are after their flesh, that's obvious to see, their fleshly desires. We have people who said, I'll depend upon myself. I'll take care of my own issues. I don't need God for anything. And we have people who say, oh yeah, no, I follow God. And they actually don't. None of these categories are sons of God. They're not the goal, the objective. They're not the drive to mimic or be like. On the other hand, Noah, who also has actions, not fleshly based, Noah is the good side. You want to follow Noah's example of observing the people around you and not participating in their corrupt ways. We want to find Isaiah's example of study what God has to say, so this will not be a shock when the people around you start having struggles and problems. We want to be like the person, not good on the outside, but as Messiah points out, good on the inside. So who's essentially doing what Moses said to do. So follow what that instruction is. Noah, Isaiah, and Moses' seat. That's the example that we're looking for the category that I'm labeling, because Paul labeled it, sons of God. That is our goal. It's our target. So we have this consistent concept being on here, and the contrast between what is and what isn't a son of God. Does it make sense? Did I lose anybody on this? All right. Any questions so far? All right. So let's summarize a little bit of this here. Okay. So what does the son of God do? Now we've discussed this in the past. I think I discussed it with I can't remember which church I talked to this, but whichever church I was talking to about this. So we have the examples of sons of God and for what's being discussed here, and the examples of what's good and what's not good and what we're trying to observe. So we erase the bad things we don't like. We don't want to do, we don't want to follow our own will. We don't want to tell God to be quiet. Don't want to do the hokey pokey. No, you're right. No hokey pokeys. We'll get rid of this part of it. So what does the son of God do? What is he? What's the characteristic traits of the son of God? We have obviously the actions that matter, right? The studying that matters from Isaiah. We have the be obedient to what Moses instructed, what he's telling us to do, what he told us to do. These are not the hokey pokey, man. You're right, Yosef. So in this case, we have sons of God. In the case of I think it's Romans 8 for call card. Let's jump to Romans 8. I'll be done in a minute, guys. I'm almost finished here. In Romans 8, what verse was that? Verse. I should have written the verse address down. It'll be a lot easier to find than just try to skim the. Yeah, those in the flesh cannot. Verse 8 can't please God. You know the flesh. Okay. So in verse 8, so Romans 8, jumping down, sorry, in verse, I jumped to verse 8. So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God. We got that from Noah, right? But you who are not in the flesh, but in the spirit, if indeed the spirit of God dwells in you, if anyone does not have the spirit of Christ, he is not his. So if you're not, doesn't belong to God. So so we have the example of the flesh can't follow him. If you have the spirit of God, you cannot, if you don't have the spirit of God, you cannot be God's. That's what he's explaining. And if verse 10, if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin, but the spirit of life because of righteousness. And the spirit of him who raised Messiah from the dead dwells in you. He who raised Christ the dead will also give you life to your mortal bodies through the spirit who dwells in you. I could have sworn I saw the sons of God thing here. I must miss that verse. Oh, there it is. Verse 15. So you did not receive the spirit again, but you received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. So now, in this case, verse 14, many who are led by the spirit of God, these are sons of God. So we have the instructions from Apostle Paul to be the sons of God, just like Jesus was, but not like just like him, in the same category. You know what I mean? Jesus is a king. We're not. But that category of sons of God, you have to be led by the spirit of God to do that. So the spirit of God, does it lead you to do good physical actions or bad physical actions? Good, right? That's pretty obvious, right? Good. So if I see somebody who claims, yeah, this is a hard one, complex question, who claims to follow or believe or obedient to God, and their actions don't match that, what do I know about them? They're not the son of God. That category is excluded from them. Now, I'm not referring to people who make mistakes. We all make mistakes. Who is choosing to make a decision and make a lifestyle that is not consistent. They continue to live in whatever that is, whatever their desires. If they're, even though they may claim, like the guy over here from Moses' seat, they may claim to do something or claim to be something. Again, if their flesh actions don't match, I know this is off. They're not the son of God. Now, let's see the study from Isaiah, the same category. So if I have the spirit of God in me, what am I doing with that spirit? Well, I'm talking with it. I'm interact life events or scenarios, but I may argue with it. That may happen because my flesh is still strong. So in the case of Isaiah, if I have the spirit of God with me, I am interacting with God. Am I not? So Isaiah, no one would argue Isaiah did not interact with God. He clearly heavily did. So if I have the spirit of God, I'm interacting with it. I'm talking to him. What were the people of Isaiah telling him? Stop talking to us, right? So again, so somebody comes along or I come along, claim that my actions, let's pretend my actions were good. They appeared good to you on the outside. But I never spoke to God in my life. Never prayed to him and the knowledge of him. Don't talk about him. I'm not classified as we modern day people call good people. We call ourselves good. Oh, I'm good. I'm a good person. Where do rock people come in? Wait a minute. What's so common is that? Rock people. Oh, because stick people. Oh, that's oh, whatever. Making fun of my stick figures. Okay, so if I'm talking to God, if I run across an individual or myself, I may have good actions, meaning they appear okay. And how can that be? How can someone have good actions but not talk to God? Simple. Live in a society that obeys God and you don't. What happens? Well, because the laws of a society will restrict and confine some of our behaviors, some of the behaviors can appear to make us good, even though we may have desires otherwise. So a good action cannot be the sole indicator of somebody is following the son of God or not, or is the son of God or not. Right, exactly. You may not be intentionally doing an action. Right, it could be the environment around you forced you to be a good action, even though you don't want to. So the actions, though, is not sufficient enough to determine a son of God or somebody who is or be like a son of God. That's a terrible penmanship. So let's go back to Isaiah. So if I'm talking to God regularly, let's say I'm praying to God all the time. All right. So I have good actions, meaning because my society forces me to, whether I want to or not. But I talk to God. I pray to him. But I do not apply what I've learned. So now I'm blinded. So, for example, I can read the Bible. I can read the prophets as Isaiah 29 said, I can read it, but I'm confused. I don't know what this means. This is weird. I don't understand it. This is too complicated. Could you just tell me what you want and move on? As opposed to actually being interested. Yeah, it'd be nice. But so if I talk to God, but I'm not comprehending what I'm talking. So I may be talking to him, but comprehension or understand what I'm reading matters. So as we learn in Isaiah 29, they couldn't understand what they're reading. This is confusing. I'm blinded. I just don't understand this. That's not a son of God. I'm not saying a son of God has to understand everything. The point is that if you're not understanding anything, this is a problem. The talking to him is of no value if it's a one-way street. If there's nothing going back to me that I can comprehend what's happening, this is not the action of a son of God. Now, I wouldn't necessarily know that of any Joe Schmo. I don't know what their personal understanding of God is. Unless they tell me, I have to just guess by looking at them. I wouldn't know. But a son of God has to have the ability to talk like Isaiah does, but he has to understand what God's talking about. What is God trying to tell us? A son of God has to try to... Now, I'm not saying we understand everything, but you just strive to work with that. I mean, that's we spend our time reading and discussing and talking about God and what he does in life, in our lives, to understand him. Now, let's go down to this last one, the Matthew 23 category, son of God. It's not just good actions because my society tells me to do good actions, and we learn from Noah, or could learn, I should say, from Noah. I have to also understand it, but I also have to know what is a good action, what isn't, by God's definition, Moses, see. Right, exactly, because modern society could come back to Noah and say, okay, Noah, we're going to now decide girls can be boys and boys can be girls, right? This is now classified as good in our society. Oh, okay. I'm following this new rule. I'm good as far as society's definition is, but I'm not actually good, right? I'm doing what is now evil in God's eyes, even though it appeared good to my culture that I lived in. So good definition, it has to be narrowly defined. It's defined by Moses. Moses defines it through him. God defined it. Moses explains it to us. So the sons of God have not just to avoid the bad behaviors, we have to actually mimic the good behaviors on the other side. So it's not sufficient to say, I'm going to avoid doing all these awful things. No, I have to do the other side too. Right. Yeah, don't you? So if let's pretend you run across a hypothetical person who avoided the awful things but wasn't doing the good things. We call them lukewarm. And what Messiah say? I'll spit you out. You're no value to me. In the middle, you're not good or bad. You're just stuck there in the middle. That's not enough. Not doing bad is not good enough. You're supposed to pursue the other side too. So a son of God is going to have these characters because they have God's spirit within inside them. So it's not just as sufficient to say, I won't do bad things. I'll try to talk to God sometimes, or I can't understand it. And Moses has just a bunch of laws. That's not sufficient enough. You actually have to do with the other side. So if you look at our Torah, it's categorized as two categories, the do's and don'ts. So let's pretend I avoid the don'ts. I make sure I don't do any of the don'ts, but I don't do any of the do's. When he says, do this, you know, I just make sure I don't do the don'ts. But I avoid. So I'm avoiding half of the stuff. So I make sure I'm not doing the bad stuff. You know, compromising, yeah, doing partially right. Right. So if you're correct, Joseph, you can't do half the way. You have to understand that, hey, there's things I don't do, but there's also things I should or need to do. Right? Makes sense? That's how those supposed to explain these to us. So it's not sufficient enough to do part of this. It's the whole package that we're dealing with when it comes to being a son of God. Does that make sense? All right. So did I lose anybody on that? Open up. So I am done early. Look at that. I talk fast, but I'm done early. Any comments or questions? Well, to be fair, these one-third cycles, you can three-year cycle, you can cover a lot more detail in a small section than you can otherwise. The one-year cycle, I'm rushing like crazy. This is kind of nice. Anyway, any comments or questions from the peanut galleries over here? No. You know, Isaac's being quiet. That's good. Any from... Anything from Hello Fellowship? Any comments or questions? Did I lose anybody? What was that? No.
Hello?
Go ahead, Elisa. Go ahead, Lisa.
This is Ann. I don't know. Someone else?
Oh, Ann? Oh, okay. I have a text here, Lisa. But Ann, I can hear you. Go ahead, Ann. What was your comment?
All right. Maybe I missed it, but you know where it says the sons of God went into the women.
Yes.
So was that sons of God? Category like you have explained the sons of God to us.
Correct. That would be that category. So where it says the sons of God going into women to have, you know, have kids and such and do what they want to do. We're not referring to the people who stayed sons of God. So referring to people who should have been or once were and then abandoned that concept. So the idea is that I've got a sons of God here. We'll put up top my board. So I have sons of God and they had a responsibility to maintain that relationship with God. But instead of retaining the relationship with God, they then said, hey, she's really cute. Lust of flesh. And they convert from sons of God to now just being flesh. So they lost their connection to God as sons of God. It became flesh. They produced kids and that was their drive. When God made mankind, it was not to have sex or to have kids. Well, kids are part of it, but that was the responsibility. It wasn't to seek self-pleasure. The point was to have a relationship with God. So you're born, you have a responsibility, a destination or a purpose in life that's to be connected to God in some way. If I then abandon that to go seek after personal self-pleasure or self-interest, I'm no longer a son of God anymore. I'm losing that status. I'm dropping down. I might be an important person in mankind's viewpoint, but I'm not being a son of God anymore. I might be somebody who's really valuable, a present or a king. I could become anything I wanted to, but that doesn't make me a son of God anymore. I've lost that status. I have now just become flesh. I'd be an important person according to flesh, but I'm still just flesh. Does that make sense? So that's what I'm talking about, the sons of God leaving their responsibility and going after the daughters of women, having it place your value system. I am not personally a subscriber to angels having sex with women. I'm just not my thing. I don't think that it makes no sense to me. God made reproductive ability on humans. He didn't make it, you know, to angels. They don't, that part of the, or it's ridiculous in my mind, but I'm not saying I'm right. That's just how I, no rock people dating service, right? I don't see that process. As far as Jeff's got a sense of humor on that. Yeah. Hey, Jeff, Isaac's complaining. You're taking his jokes away from him. Anyway. So does that make sense, Anne? So,
yeah, well, the Hebrew word for sons of God and the word for angels would be different, right? Malik?
Yes. Something. Yes, they are not the same. There's not the same word. Correct.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure. It's a different pronunciation, Melek and servant. Elisa, you had a question. What was your comment, Elisa?
Yeah, I'll translate for her.
Go for it.
Just a comment. I always had doubt that who were the sons of God. You know, with the... And now, like it says in the last times, in the last days, it'll be like in the times of Noah.
And right.
It's apparent that in those times, it's very difficult for a young person to stay when there's so much temptation. They'll go with the women of, you know, the world, or vice versa, the women with the men of the world. And it's true that we have to be hotter or cold. Like the Bible says, we can't be, you know, timid. And for me, I feel that, you know, I'm in the middle and I need to do what the Torah says completely and what the lay has shown us to do, the law has shown us to do, not just understand, but know them and do them. And that's just my comment there. Thank you.
It's an excellent, excellent observation. In order to return like the days of Noah, we have to have not a duplicate, but a similar concept, a similar vision, a similar experience. Well, you're not going to have angels coming down and having babies with women. That doesn't make any sense in a modern day culture. But what does make perfect sense is people whose destination was to follow God, abandon him, and then follow after the desires of flesh. That is so uber, uber prevalent here in our culture. So that part of the component does make sense again to me, and that's how, you know, alien visitations. Yeah, I'm not an alien visitors from space or whatever. Yes, Joy, where is it? It says, oh right, at the end. Oh crud, I don't remember the address. So she's asking where. Maybe somebody else does the address where it says at the end times your greed or your desires, your greed. If you're careful of the end times, I don't know that. Okay. Okay. Right. Whatever you desire, right? That same category, right? So she pointed out, it doesn't necessarily have to be a female per se. You could desire wealth, power, money, whatever. all those, whatever you're desiring, your desires can categorize the same greed, the same grouping that does not a connection to God anymore. It's not isolated just a particular category, because in Noah's day, I imagine they were doing more than just self-pleasure, because there's violence and robbery. There's physical harm taking place as well, or stealing. There's other things that they're after, not just physical self-pleasure. So there's probably a whole category of things that we're talking about that people can be greedy for, to desire for. And those are all pull you away from God. Oh, okay. So the questions. Any comments or questions? Yeah, no alien visitations. I'm not a fan of that. Crop circles. Anyway. Carrie, go ahead, Carrie.
I was just thinking we have to rewind a little bit for this view, but in the at least one chapter before, basically what it's talking about is the first two sons of Adam, where the one was righteous and the other one wasn't. And he's told sin lies at the door. And then what happens right with his sons is all unrighteousness. So to me, when I read the sons of God, you know, started to marry the daughters of men, it kind of almost seems like the descendants of Seth are being juxtaposed against the descendants of Cain, where it seems like in his lineage, people are choosing against God. And then people in Seth's lineage are choosing God, but then, of course, then they start to mix. So that's just kind of always how I've seen it, where it's like, that's that fleshly, but it's like, you know, here's the descendants of Cain, and it kind of went sideways. And then here's the descendants of Seth, and it was kind of going good for a little while. And then, blech.
Right. So it's interesting, this is a little bit further off topic, but the same thread, is that there's a reason why in Judaism they contrast the name lists for Cain's line and Adam's line. The lists are identical. The names are the same. There's one name that's swapped, it's the same name. And so in Jewish theological tradition is that Cain and Seth are the same person. And this is their theological tradition, not their belief, but it's tradition. And that each human being has a evil nature and a good nature inside them, and they had to control it. There's a part of them that failed and did not control, and part that did succeed. I'm not saying they're correct, that I don't think they're correct, meaning that I don't think they're physically correct. I don't think they're biologically, I don't think they're the same. But the idea of the contrasting a good and bad behavior across the board, and it is a matter of intense control over oneself to suppress that which is desires of your flesh in order to pursue the instructions of God. I can't say they're right or wrong. Nobody can say what's right or wrong, but the idea of dealing with that which is evil, that which is good, is a continual battle. And you have, again, Jewish tradition that Noah married Nahama, as far as the wife, and her being the mom. She was from Cain's line. And so this continuous like interaction always occurs. And I'm not saying it's correct. I'm just saying that it's a conceptual idea being discussed on that same thread. Carrie, you have a follow-up comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, that just reminded me. I had a different question from earlier. I noticed in reading chapter 5 that there were actually only two sons where it says that the father named them. The other ones, it just says that they were begotten. And I was curious, because I know in other places in scripture, sometimes the name is given to somebody when the story's told, not necessarily the name they were born with. I was curious if there's any scholarship on that question.
That question falls in the category of definitions of their names. And so I don't, it's been probably over a decade since I looked at all the names, meanings and such, and how they got them. I can't remember exactly, but it's a little vague for me, so I apologize. Some of the names, it's theoretically thought or taught or assumed or thought that they were assigned that name after an event in their life or some point in life. So like Methuselah, whose end will come, right? The oldest, right? And he dies the flood or near to it. And the idea being that when he dies, that's the end will be it, will happen. And whether or not that was his name beforehand or not, I don't know. It could be given to him afterward. So I don't have a good answer to that. I do know that there are instances in our biblical text where the sons are not named by the father, and some instances where the name of the mom, specifically, obviously Jacob's sons, were all named by the moms, not Jacob. But I don't have enough recollection memory on that detail, so I can't really give a good answer for it. But it is an interesting thought that people have discussed that over the years on how someone got their name and when did that name apply, when did it not. Any comments or questions? All right.
Yep.
Well, anything else then? Sam. Sam, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah. With Genesis chapter 6, and I believe the scripture, when we talk about the context, when you look at it, it's right after verse 3 of chapter 6. In verse 4, he said the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughter of men, and they bore children to them, those who are the mighty men who are of old, men of renown. So, you know, to the scriptures, you have to sometimes go outside or take yourself to the things that, you know, in the culture of the day. How is it going to be possible or any of us to comprehend three angels visiting Abraham, a human being? And the scripture said God was among them, okay? So that is the Torah portion in a yearly cycle. The angels did visit human, according to the scripture. So in my interpretation of this verse, it is there are fallen angels backed up by the book of Enoch that shows that's my interpretation. That's the way I see it with, you know, some scripture that can we can see that there are events that occurred in those days that are not happening in our times. Before the birth of the Master, Angel Gabriel appeared to Mary, okay? So not in a dream, but with the Joseph, we know it was in the dream. The scripture make it clear. There are some events that in those days, because of the way things are moving, God is a progressive God. And so is the event that takes place on the earth. So there are certain things that happen in those days that will never happen here on earth again in our time. But that does not mean that they never happened. So in my interpretation, looking at the scriptures, those, the sons of God, because when he talks somewhere, he said, let us. So some interpreted that as maybe he's talking, maybe Yeshua, maybe this, maybe that, maybe he's talking to the angels. What we tend to forget sometimes is that the heaven, the God, the way things are, it's a kingdom. Heaven is a real place. God set it up. Otherwise, he wouldn't tell Moses, the pattern that I show you, where is that pattern? Where is the blueprint of the Mishkan, the first one that was built? Because he told him the way I show you, you must build it. So sometimes we have to kind of, you know, just look at the scripture, and because when we interpret the scripture in the modern time, we're going to miss out. We're going to lose some things that happened in those days that in our time, we cannot see it happening again. So that is just my, you know, my comment on that verse.
And it's a fair comment. It's not that I would argue or believe that angels cannot manifest themselves as a human being. Clearly they could do that as far as appearance-wise. That wasn't what the discussion to say was disagreeing with. The question being was, what does this event happen to be? Is it possible that this is a one-time event? Yes, Enoch does. The book of Enoch does imply that. And I don't know for certain. Nobody knows. Enoch's book, I can't remember the year it was written. It's somewhere. It's apocryphal time slot. So it's between Malachi and Matthew's time period, that those 100, whatever, 200 years there, when it was written, as far as the records, as far as I should say when it's written, when scholars believe it was written, based on language. So it's possible that Enoch is correct in that that's the source of all demons, which is what Enoch is arguing, that has a course or a location where demonic world came from, was this biological interaction between angels and women. I personally am not saying that's absolutely right or wrong. I just don't seem to subscribe to that. Tammy, you have a comment on this as well. Go ahead, Tammy.
Yeah, I just actually finished a study on the Book of Enoch not too long ago. And the speculation about the sons of daughters, you know, the daughters of son, men and all that, is the traditional teaching is not that the angels or the fallen angels literally had some sort of sexual conjugal relationship with human women. What the teaching goes is that these fallen spirits would basically demonically possess people who would actually want to be demon possessed because they wanted the demons to give them power and authority and this kind of thing. And then they became Nephilim. They became giants, not because they were physically giant or anything like that. The reason they became Nephilim is because they voluntarily put themselves under the authority of demons. And so when they would these quote sons of men, these fallen angels basically would have enter into relationships with women, then they would actually create dynasties of families of quote giants, of tyrants, of, you know, basically evil people who would then create empire. Nimrod is a prime example of a Nephilim, not because he was literally the physical descendant of a demon and the literal physical descendant of a woman or something like that. It's because he voluntarily submitted himself to demons for the purpose of gaining power and control over human beings to create power and wealth for himself and for his family and to subjugate and, oppress others and create empire by doing that. So that's why you see, even after the flood, it's like, wait a minute, if the Nephilim were all washed away by the flood, why are we reading about Nephilim and Canaan when Joshua comes to conquer it? Who are these Nephilim?
Right.
Because these Nephilim were not physically giants. It was more the fact that they were entering into a demonic relationships and then getting power from being involved with the demonic world. So
that's possible.
Yeah.
Yep, it's possible. I won't say this is or isn't as far as physically is right or wrong necessarily. I happen to interpret sons of God a particular way, but obviously there are different variations. It's not dependent upon our different belief system. But I do want to make sure as we all understand the principles being taught in our Torah, in the Torah portion, the Haftarah portion. What's the principle being taught? Our actions are the goal here, and what we do and how we deal with our God, interact with other people. That is our objective as far as the lessons being taught. The details of whether or not some obviously would argue that Nephilim were could be demon possessed, could be some biological thing. I don't subscribe to that. Doesn't mean I'm right. I don't subscribe to that because I personally don't have intense value in that particular interpretation because it doesn't change how I act in my life. But I can't argue that something is definitely is or isn't. I could just say, well, I perceive it one way and somebody else perceives it differently, but the principles we're trying to learn here, the principle behind it. So there'll be differences in every congregation you go to, whether it's a Christian congregation or a Jewish congregation. Every one of them interprets this exact same passage differently. Even inside a congregation, there are differences, different interpretations, but inside the same room, they all view it differently. It's okay to have differences. That's totally fine. You have this comment about what's the... Could that be why the Tsar, or the Prince of Persia, persisted from one generation to the next? That theoretically, as far as that comment you have written here, any of the principalities of the air that control a particular country can outlast the flesh. That's obvious. We die, and they don't. So the demon can go beyond that. I'm not going to go into details of how Messiah dealt with them and how the whole pig swine thing in the water, but somehow that did something different. I'm not sure what it was. But so you can have different princes or different principalities. When you have the 70 nations being called in Genesis, well, clearly there's more than 70. There's a different numbers. But it's an average value of roughly 70. Well, what makes a nation a nation? Is it a demonic influence, a spiritual influence, or just a decision by people deciding to be a nation together? I don't know. There's no way of knowing what makes a nation a nation, other than what God decides is or what a demon decides is. So the Prince of Persia, maybe, maybe not. Hard to say where it comes from. But either way, they persisted as far as those princes or principalities persist. The idea being here, I purposely didn't want to focus too much attention on the Nephilim component as well as the actions being talked about. What were the people actually doing? What was right? What was wrong with it? That's what I wanted to focus on today.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.